August 2011 marks the 6th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina and the destruction it brought to the Gulf Coast of the United States. In this month's episode of the History Explorer podcast, we hear an interview with the late David Shate, a curator who worked in the museum's Work and Industries division. In 2005, Mr. Shate and colleagues set out to collect objects from areas affected by the hurricane, and he later sat down with museum educator Carrie Cacho to discuss the act of collecting in the wake of a natural disaster and the types of objects that were brought back to the museum.
Okay, I'm David Shate. I'm a curator in the Division of Work and Industry at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. In the Division of Work and Industry, I study the history of engineering and hand tools in American life. Construction equipment, mining, not so much mining, but really things above ground involving the building of structures, and sometimes the taking down of structures.
So we're going to focus on objects from that you've collected from Katrina. So I would imagine that most people would be interested in knowing, how did you decide that the museum was going to collect these objects? How did that process happen? When did it happen?
All museum work in one form or another is digging in the dirt. We dig in the dirt of old factories to find old machines and blueprints. We dig in musty film vaults to find old films. We look at old jazz and orchestral performances in musty, dirty people's houses, sometimes concert halls. So it's a process of digging and searching and looking and sort of looking for the unknown, the unexpected. When Katrina hit, it was a natural response for me to take interest, to show interest in thinking about ways of preserving what quickly became a national tragedy, not just a local or regional event, but one with truly national scope, and that's why we got involved.
When Katrina hit, I mean, when you were watching the news, did you immediately start thinking this is something we have to collect, or how did that work for you?
It took a few days after Katrina came and went through the Gulf Coast for me to realize that this could be a collecting opportunity. Normally, of course, our country has many hurricanes, storms, tornadoes, lightning strikes, volcanoes, earthquakes, but rarely, if ever, do we get involved. So I wasn't necessarily keen to do this or thinking hard about what objects to collect until I was asked to think about it seriously by our leadership. There was a collective judgment made by the curatorial staff and the museum management that something needed to be done. And what that usually means in a museum is something needed to be collected. It was not enough for aid to go down there. Personally, I put together a bucket of cleaning supplies and carried them to a church in my local community of Gaithersburg, Maryland, to drop them off in the days right after Hurricane Katrina. Soap, sponges, a mop, cleaning supplies, gloves. So I was very much in the artifact giving mode, not the artifact taking at the outset. So it really took direction by this museum for me to get seriously involved. I was selected in part because of my experience during the aftermath of September 11th, 2001, when due to my connections in New York City, I was part of a team that collected objects and artifacts from that experience. So I'd had some field work under my belt and knew, in a sense, what to expect, but we really hadn't ever before until now collected a natural disaster. Hugh Tallman's a photographer on the staff. Hugh Tallman and I went to the Katrina part of the country twice, two-week trips. The first occurred in early September 2005, and the second in early December of the same year, just about 3 months apart. We went to different sites on each trip. We talked to many different people. We attempted to not just focus on New Orleans, but the entire Gulf Coast, a daunting task in every way, given the miles involved, the number of people to deal with, and the sheer accumulation of objects. What was in our favor was the freshness of our response. We didn't wait too long before buying plane tickets and renting a car in a fairly desolate airport in New Orleans to start making our way around, and right away we found things and found people to talk to.
Okay, let's talk specifically then about some of the objects that you brought back. You talked about some jazz-related objects, a hat and a clarinet.
Every curator acquires a unique collection of some kind or other. There's no one collection that everyone looks for. So they're idiosyncratic. In my case, I tried to acquire objects that were emblematic of certain major stories surrounding Katrina, stories of loss and recovery, stories of art and science, the science of the hurricane, the art of the city of New Orleans and the peoples around it. And clearly music was a part of that. The music of New Orleans, the jazz scene, the sound of jazz in the streets. Jazz very much a part of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina because so much was lost. Artists left the area. Musical collections were lost in private homes, in museums. I learned through a radio station of Dr. Michael White, a local jazz performer, professor, collector of clarinets, and a victim of Hurricane Katrina. His house in the Gentilly district was flooded with 9 feet of water from the break in the London Avenue Canal when that levee failed hours after Hurricane Katrina came through. Weeks, perhaps months later, he was able to enter his house and find a devastated scene. His collection of sheet music and CDs and records and clarinets was lost, completely covered with seawater and mud and all kinds of molds and vermin, very much back to nature in a very soupy condition. But in the process of meeting with him, we actually helped him empty his house and hauled out through a broken window clarinet after clarinet after clarinet in moldy, rotting cases. I selected one of those at his with his approval to add to the collections, a 1930s Pan American Special from Elkhart, Indiana, a metal clarinet, so it has held up pretty well. Its case, which I also collected of blue velvet and wood, is in pretty shabby shape, but I wanted that as well, so that too is here. And it's dried out, of course, but adds a certain flavor and character to this lovely silver clarinet that he donated. On top of that, his baseball cap, jazz in New Orleans, adds a literal aspect to the story. And in addition, Herman Leonard, the great Herman Leonard, and his jazz photography is part of the collection here, too. I met with Herman at his studio, also flooded out, also a victim of great loss, and received from him a framed photo of Miles Davis and another one of Lena Horne. These were badly damaged in the flood, but because they were bubble-wrapped, they floated for weeks on top of the floodwaters in his studio. So they have this very interesting vignette of mold and growth coming in from the edges of these beautiful black-and-white prints inside their frames. So those two are an aspect of jazz and jazz history that are here at the Smithsonian.
So we talked about loss a little bit. Let's talk about rescue and during the storm. You have at least one object that has to do with the rescue aspect.
Because the Smithsonian was not present during the hurricane itself, even a few hours or a few days later, prevented us from witnessing the actual act of the hurricane and, of course, the actual recovery and survival of many victims. The evacuees we hear about, the people who walked ashore out of the floodwaters, who were carried to safety. But what about those who stayed behind and had to be airlifted out up a rope or in a sling? For that, we went to the Coast Guard Naval Air Station in New Orleans and collected from them an actual basket and a harness they call a strop or a quick strop that they used over and over and over again to lift people out of floodwaters, off the top of roofs, out of trees, out of stranded areas in New Orleans. Hundreds of airplanes and helicopters filled the skies of New Orleans after Katrina, the day after, and in some cases during the storm. These were life-saving efforts. Many thousands were rescued, and these brave men and women of the Coast Guard and other forces risked their lives to rescue these people. We had to acknowledge that and represent both sides of that story, the rescuer and the survivor. And we've done that emphatically with this basket and this harness. We interviewed many officers. They lined up to be talked to. People are grateful for the attention. Sometimes especially in a case like Katrina, where the rescue effort was a secondary story to the stories of struggle and loss and pain and discomfort. So they were very grateful, the officers of the U.S. Coast Guard, the pilots, the rescue swimmers, the people who went down into the water, the people who commanded the winches and hoists. They were appreciative, frankly. So we talked with them at length, took their pictures from many angles. I took many notes about the process, the technical process of rescuing people from the air. And hopefully we'll find ways to use that, ways like this.
We can talk a little bit, I guess, about cleanup. And the signs that we talked about last time seemed mostly to do with cleanup, but were they also the ones that people saw on TV that were, you know, please help us, those kinds of signs?
Signs matter. Signs are symbols. And, of course, for us, they're straight-ahead, almost self-written labels, museum labels. But the signs of New Orleans, the signs of Katrina, are exactly that. They are signs posted along the roadside, seeking help, complaining, offering services, and we collected quite a host of them. Everything from the hurricane evacuation route sign, the big blue circle that people saw to direct them, if they were driving, to direct them out of the city, to little homemade signs out of cardboard that say, God bless you, Slidell, or God be with you. Lots of religious associations, stores announcing their reopening, and certainly a host of cleanup offers. Never before have I seen so many advertisements for house gutting services, mold removal, house cleaning, and of course the removal of the infamous brown line that characterizes Katrina's visit, this coffee stain that you see rising and falling throughout the city where the floodwaters sat for days and weeks, in some cases multiple lines as tides rose and fell or as the pumps kicked in and cut off. We have several examples of objects pulled from the city that show that, some signs, but of course the signs that are emblematic of the resilient American desire to make money, to have enterprise, even in a disaster zone like that. So signs that say, get rid of your Katrina water stain, or dirty dudes, call this number. Websites offering legal services to help with people with no flood insurance, seeking to find their car or to sell their house. So for me, I wanted to capture that, and I collected about 24 signs that reflect that. Happily, they're fairly modest in size, so I could stack them up nicely, and they await opportunities to be used. One of the signs that we collected is a supplication. It says, "Have we been forgotten?" Large plywood sign from the outskirts of New Orleans. People left by the side of the road as aid trucks zoomed by. I think signs like that, and like the enterprising signs that offer services, testify to this enduring American trust in one another, that somebody's reading these signs, that there's faith, there's hope that there is a brighter future around the corner if they can just get their message out, make some money, get some attention, get some food for their family, get some help from the government. It's a polite cry for assistance, basically. And I would even say that about the businesses that put up signs offering services. Those who didn't have signs, in many cases undocumented day laborers from across the border, they simply showed up, offering to work with the sweat of their brow and their muscles, their back muscles, to make some money, to make a living. So there was a case of enterprise with no sign, and we even dealt with them. The desolation of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast was the most striking and memorable aspect of our trip down there. The lack of people, lack of automobiles, the fairly vacant, windswept landscape, both within New Orleans and along the Gulf Coast, most memorable. But in many cases, there was resilience. There were signs of new life and the return of the old culture. In some cases, the return of new cultures. In the case of Biloxi, Mississippi, we met with immigrant Vietnamese shrimp families, families who had escaped another storm, the storm of the Vietnam War, in the 1970s to find similar living and working conditions along the Gulf Coast, following a trade they knew well, fishing, catching shrimp, ocean-going vessels, managing the sea, as well as a family. Going down to the Vietnamese-based harbor and the shrimp boats of the inner harbor of Biloxi, we ran into one shrimper in particular, Mr. Sang Nguyen. He took us aboard his ship and presented us with some things long after we had walked on board. He didn't realize we wanted something from his work life. He was simply giving us a tour of the shrimp boat. But I knew from instructions I'd received back here that we wanted something very particular for our own programming and collections. So once we got on the bridge of his ship inside the cabin, I was looking around desperately for some Vietnamese totem, some symbol of his old country, of his culture, that helps him in his daily shrimping life and perhaps has helped him recover from the losses he suffered. His family lost their home, they lost their two vehicles, and they had all moved to Panama City, Florida. He was simply coming back that day to check on his ship. Little did he realize that he was going to lose something else that day, because on board the ship, in the cabin, in the bridge, I found a homemade timing device that he uses above the wheel of the cabin to chart the times when he drops shrimp nets out in the Gulf. He leaves them there for set periods, 3 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours. And in this little simple cardboard Vietnamese character sign he made for himself with a clock dial and clock hands, he, in a very self-resilient way, showed me that he's going to make it. He's going to be fine. He donated that together with an extra fish release, a stainless steel cage that is inserted into the mouth of a shrimp net that allows large fish to escape so that he doesn't disobey the law and catch fish while he's looking for shrimp. So between those two small objects and my interview with him and our photography, we captured a very special culture that has ridden the storm and will, I think, prevail despite the ravages of Katrina.
As you look into the future and you see these objects, do you see this collection growing over time?
The Katrina collection is probably at an end. It's probably finished. Not that we wouldn't be interested in hearing about other interesting objects. For example, just recently in the last few weeks, I've received, at my request, a couple little miniature wooden houses made by a woman whose son lost her house in the flood of Katrina. She made these little houses as Christmas tree ornaments to give to her family. Every year she seems to make an interesting ornament, but in this case she made little flooded houses with the little brown water line and the FEMA sticker and the National Guard notice and the eviction card, all carefully colored onto these little wooden houses. So things like that that might tell a story that we're interested in, the collection is still open for. But it's essentially a done story. God forbid that another such hurricane comes through, but we are ready for other disasters should they strike. Disaster collecting has become a rarely used but important field for the Smithsonian, one that was established just a few years ago, but one that we continue to explore and study and think about ways of improving.
That was the late curator David Shate, being interviewed by Carrie Cacho. For the History Explorer podcast series, this is Matt Ringelstetter. Join us again next month as we take another look behind the scenes here at the National Museum of American History. Podcast made possible by a grant from the Verizon Foundation.